Chapter 32. I'd always suspected that Mark's keycard opened every lock in the building, so I wasn't surprised when I got home that night and found him sitting at my dining room table. He shot to his feet when I came in. "Where the fuck were you?" As he took in what I was wearing, he added, incredulous, "Running?" I went for a long run in the park. I guess I lost track of the time. I needed to think. "Well, I needed to talk to you. Come here." He gestured to the laptop open on the table. "You have to see this."
"Okay, just let me grab a shower."
"No, now," he insisted, and he pointedly pulled out the chair next to his. He'd spent the day at the ICE facility in Elizabeth, he told me. One of the four women on my list had already been processed out, a euphemism for deported. But he was able to interview the other three with the help of the interpreters he took with him. He had videos of all three interviews. "Watch," he said, and pushed a button on the keyboard. The video flickered onto the screen. A young Asian woman sat at a table with her hands folded prayer-like in front of her. Mark's voice sounded off-screen, and as the woman answered, another voice could be heard off-screen, in a halting translation. The young woman's name was Po, and she was from a small village in Cambodia. It was very poor, and there was not enough work and not enough food for her family. She learned that there were jobs in Kampot, and so she walked there, over many days, to a job center near the city. The people there put her on a bus to an airstrip near the coast. Hundreds of people were waiting there, men and women and children, most from Cambodia, but others from Thailand and Vietnam. They'd all heard there was good work here, though no one knew what it was. They had to wait a long time until a plane appeared high in the sky. It circled the airstrip slowly, like a vulture, and the people craned their necks and shaded their eyes to watch it. Finally, it landed, and the stairs came down, and a fancy lady came out. She was very pale, with hair nearly as white as her skin. Some people thought she had an American accent, and some thought it was British. She wore clothes like Po had only ever seen in a magazine.
"Gotta be Lucy Barton Jones," Mark said.
Another woman walked behind the fancy lady, holding an umbrella over her head, and a third woman trailed after them, with many bottles of water in her arms. They went into the hangar, garage, the translator said first, then corrected herself. And after a few bewildered minutes, the people followed. A platform had been set up inside, with two tables in front of it. The fancy lady stood on the platform, and the other two women sat at the tables, with big stacks of red and green cards. The fancy lady had a microphone, and she told the people about the jobs they would have. They would make clothes, she told them, in a factory, but a bigger, better factory than they had ever seen. It had air conditioning, the fancy lady said. So did the rooms where the workers would sleep, and the big room where they would eat their meals. Mark's voice interrupted to tell the interpreter to ask for the name of the facility, but Po didn't know its name or who owned it.
"Paradis sur Terre," he said to me. "It's gotta be."
I didn't answer. The fancy lady told the people to line up at the tables, and when their turn came, they answered some questions and were handed either a red card or a green card. If they got a green card, it meant they got a job. Po got a green card and was told to line up outside at the edge of the airstrip. She was so happy. The people with red cards trudged away with sad faces. The fancy lady left on her plane, and the workers waited in the sun a long time, wondering what they were waiting for and what they were supposed to do. Finally, a cloud of dust appeared at the far end of the airstrip, and a line of buses chugged into view. All the people with green cards were told to get on. Po was nervous, but she was also very excited about her new job. She thought she would work hard and make much money to send to her family. She thought she would do so well that she would someday get an even better job.
Maybe one day she might pass out green and red cards and carry the umbrella for the fancy lady. She was on the bus for 2 days. It was hot and crowded and had no facilities. 3 times a day it stopped by the roadside so everyone could get off and go into the bushes. They were given bottled water and plastic packets of unfamiliar food to eat. During the second day, they drove deep into the jungle on a road so narrow that the leaves brushed the bus windows on both sides. Everything was green and dense and impenetrable. There were many snakes, and when they stopped, Po was afraid to go very far into the bushes. Once they saw a tiger, its yellow eyes gleaming through the thick leaves. But at last, a clearing appeared in the jungle. Po pressed her face to the grimy bus window and marveled at all the buildings. They were new and brightly colored, and some were 2 and even 3 stories tall.
Paradis sur terre, Mark said again, no question.
But still, he peered at me for confirmation, and still, I didn't respond. Po got a job sewing sleeves on shirts. She made many mistakes at first, but her supervisor was kind and told her not to worry, that the cost of her mistakes would be deducted from her account. Her account, she understood, was where the money would be held until she could send it home to her family. But she never understood how it worked. When she asked to send it home, she was told there wasn't enough money in it yet. And when she went to the store to buy soap or toothpaste, she was sometimes told she didn't have enough money for that either. It was confusing. It wasn't until the second year, after everyone was made to work double shifts, that she was able to send a little money to her father. On the video, Mark interrupted to clarify what she meant by double shift. The translation came through. 16 hours a day, 6 days a week. This was for a long time. Then one day last year, an airplane came out of the sky, and it was the fancy lady again. Po had not seen her since that first day in Kampot, and she was very excited and pushed to the front of the crowd to get a close look. The fancy lady looked much older than she had before. Po thought she must have been ill, and maybe that was why she hadn't been to visit sooner. The fancy lady stood on a platform with a microphone and told them, in English, while 3 different interpreters translated for the workers, that she had some unhappy news, but also some very happy news for them. The unhappy news was that this factory would be closing. The happy news was that she'd found new jobs for all of them. Excellent work, far from here. It meant that some families would have to be separated. There was different work for the men and the women and the children. But the children weren't so very young, and it was only temporary, and they would all be so much better off when they were reunited. And here was the most exciting part. Airplanes would come to fly them to their new jobs. Po had never been on an airplane in her life, and she was very excited as she ran to her room and packed her few belongings. Then the workers assembled at the edge of the airstrip and were given different colored cards to tell them which plane to get on. Some of the mothers cried when their children got different cards, but the boss men took them inside and explained things to them again, and they came back with their faces down and hugged their children goodbye and waited with their own groups. Po was lucky. She got to sit next to one of the tiny oval windows, and she pressed her face against it as the airplane skimmed the top of the teak trees until it rose high above the clouds. When the clouds parted, she saw that they were over the sea, but no one knew which one it was. No one knew where they landed, either. It was an airstrip, but there were no buildings, not even a hangar, as there was back in Kampot. There were 2 big trucks waiting in black clouds of diesel smoke, and there were men waiting at the bottom of the airplane stairs when they came down. And they shouted and pushed and said, "Get on, hurry up!" And the women started to cry as they were herded into the trailers. Po cried too. She'd heard the stories. and now she realized this would be her story too. Mark stopped the video.
You know how it goes from here.
I nodded. He stood up and thrust his hands in his pockets and paced around the table to the French doors and gazed out into the night garden.
It's CDMI, obviously. The factory closed and the traffickers swooped in and sold the workers into slavery. And if I could only prove that management had knowledge that this might happen,
I cut him off. What if they had more than knowledge? What if they were the ones who sold them? He spun from the window and stared at me. Just hypothetically, I said, to cover up the losses at PST and defend against your lawsuit and maintain their jobs and comp packages. His eyes opened wide. He went a full minute without blinking.
If I could prove that, he said finally, I could bring down the whole management team, all the way up to Claudine DeMartineau.
I nodded. And you'd recover millions from the D&O carrier. Your shareholder clients would be rolling in equity. His face was flushed. His eyes were gleaming. He was more aroused at this moment than he'd been in bed last night.
So how do I prove it?
I shook my head sadly. Not through Poe. She doesn't even know who she was working for or where. I assume the other two women can't help either. He frowned. Then I guess you're at a loss, I said. He pulled his hands from his pockets and stalked toward me with his fists clenched.
Damn it, Shay!
I'd tantalized him. I'd aroused him. And now he was furious that I was denying him his climax.
You know how to prove it. Do it, and you not only help me, you help yourself.
How so? He gritted his teeth.
By showing the company's motive for framing you for Barton Jones.
I shrugged. I don't need to show a motive, only that they framed me, and we've already done that. The DA's agreed to dismiss the charges.
Oh?
Instantly, he changed tactics. He came back around the table and dropped to his knees beside my chair.
Shay.
He took my hand in his and gently stroked my palm.
Tell me what you know. This can be a game changer for both of us.
More for you than for me, I think. I pulled my hand free and got up and went to the kitchen and poured myself a glass of water. He came up behind me and gripped my hips.
This can be good for both of us.
He pitched his voice low and sexy as he nuzzled my neck. He was deploying his greatest weapon.
We can be quite a team, you and me. I mean, God, we already are.
His left hand moved up to squeeze my breast as he brushed his lips against my ear. I stepped away and regarded him from arm's length as I sipped the water. If I were going to reveal attorney-client confidential information, not to mention violate my NDA, it would have to be worth my while. A spark lit in his eyes with the certainty that he'd won. Now we were only negotiating price.
Sure, just tell me what you want.
I want you to remove Ingram Barrett as general counsel. A look of enormous relief spread over his face.
Of course, that goes without saying.
And replace him with me. His smile froze for a moment before it splintered and fell away.
You're joking.
Why? You don't think I'm qualified?
It's not that.
You don't think I've earned it?
No, of course you have.
Then what's the problem, Mark? He spread his hands in a gesture of helplessness.
GC is a job for a 55-year-old man, not a 30-year-old woman.
Well, that is a problem, I said. I bit out the next words. Now you fix it. He stared at me. All I'm asking for is a job, Mark. Meanwhile, I'm giving you control of the whole fucking company. He chewed his lip. 5-year contract, at, let's say, half the salary Barrett's been pulling, and I'll throw in a release of the company from all liability for what it did to me. That's worth a few million dollars to the shareholders. He gave a tentative nod.
What happens after 5 years?
After 5 years, you'll be begging me to stay, at twice the salary.
Christ.
He barked a laugh. The ball's on you. But not undeserved, I said. After all, I outmaneuvered the great Mark Ivins. His smile faded.
Let me print out the employment contract I drafted, and we'll hash out the terms.
I put the glass down on the counter.
And then I'll tell you everything you need to know about CDMI management and their involvement in human trafficking.
I crossed the room to my desk.
Oh, and Mark?
I added as I sat down at the computer.
If you ever think about double-crossing me on this?
He sputtered a protest.
I recorded Nelson Ledbetter admitting that you conspired with him to set up Ned Bartman, and that you're paying him off with a plum position at Genco. I don't think you'd want that to get out.
He froze, and I sent him a smile over my shoulder as I pushed print.
Chapter 33. This is ridiculous, Melanie complained as Barrett helped her into the limo at the airport. You barely spent a minute with me the whole time we were in Paris, and now you're not even coming home with me?
Sorry. Have to go straight to the office.
The porter was still loading her bags in the back as she settled into her seat in a huff. All her bags were full and well over the airline weight limits. The excess baggage penalties were nothing, though, compared to the cost of the goods inside. Barrett leaned in for a kiss, and she turned her face away so that his lips grazed her ear. She batted him away, and he stepped back and closed her door. The company limo pulled up behind, and he got in and powered up his phone. He'd been offline for 8 hours, but given the speed at which events were moving, it could have been a year. The single minute he'd looked upon Madame felt like a year, too, and his memory of that horror. That was how elastic time was these days. He called Tony Lowe first, and got an intercept message that the call could not be completed. That could be attributed to local congestion in KL, but it could also mean that Tony had ditched his phone, which he did from time to time. Jack Culligan should know, so Barrett called him next. He got his voicemail. His next call was to Phil Duval. He'd tried to reach him a few times from Paris, but each time Duval's assistant reported that he was in conference and couldn't be disturbed. Now she reported that he was out of town. He held his thumb on the end call button for a long time. It was just as he'd feared. He was completely on his own. Everyone else had jumped ship, Lucy and Madame included, in their own way. They'd all left him alone at the helm to navigate around the icebergs and bring the company into port. At the same time that pirates like Mark Ivins were trying to board. It was an impossible task. He didn't know if he could do it. At Marketplace Tower, he left the driver to deal with his luggage and took the elevator to the 13th floor. There was some kind of disturbance in the aviary behind the reception desk. The doves weren't cooing. They were squawking and flapping their wings in agitation. He saw why. A Mexican was in there running a squeegee over the glass walls. Even the unflappable Marcia seemed agitated when she met him in the corridor and took his briefcase from him.
"Welcome back, Mr. Barrett," she greeted him with forced heartiness.
In a lower voice, she said,
"Mr. Gutman is in your office."
"Who?"
"Miss Barton Jones's husband? I'm sorry, he was most insistent."
Barrett scowled. "Give him 10 minutes, then make up a call that I have to take."
"Very good."
Elliot Gutman jumped to his feet as Barrett came in.
"What the hell's going on, Barry?" he shouted. "Why'd they drop the charges?"
Barrett stopped, his arm extended for a handshake that wouldn't happen.
"What are you talking about?"
"The DA dropped the charges against that Lambert woman."
Barrett's arm fell. "Fuck," he said. Then,
"Marcia!"
Her reply drifted through the speaker.
"Yes, Mr. Barrett."
"Get me who's it,
that detective. Wiley. Riley. Right away.
They're calling it suicide, Gutman wailed. Do you know what that's going to do to my sons? And what about the insurance?
Okay, calm down, Barrett said. Sit down. We'll get to the bottom of this. The call connected.
Mr. Barrett,
the old detective's voice sounded through the Ma Bell speaker.
What can I do for you today?
I'll tell you what you can do. You can explain what you're thinking, dismissing the case against Lambert. I mean, what the hell? Riley made a noise that sounded suspiciously like a chuckle.
Happens I'm right outside your building. Why don't I come up and explain it to you in person?
Fine, you do that, Barrett bit out. And as the call ended, he shouted at Marcia again,
Get Jack Culligan up here.
It wasn't suicide, Gutman said. I know that now.
Of course it wasn't.
I've been remembering something she said that night before she went to the office. She said she wouldn't have our boys grow up under a cloud the way she did. Her family. They're fine people, really. I mean, she's got a cousin in the House of Lords. But she always felt that their past cast a shadow over her. The family disgrace, you know? It left a stain. She said she wouldn't allow that to happen to our sons. Her suicide would have cast a terrible shadow over the boys. So I know she wouldn't have done it. She couldn't have.
Barrett stared at him a moment before he grabbed the cigarette pack from his breast pocket and strode to the outer door. The wind was whipping across the balcony, and the saplings in the planter boxes were arching their trunks against it. The plexiglass walls that surrounded the balcony were only 3 feet tall, and he had to hunker down behind them to keep the flame burning long enough to get the cigarette lit. Inside, Gutman flopped on one of the sofas. Barrett stayed outside, leaning against the stainless steel edge and puffing on the cigarette in quick, sharp inhalations. The door from the outer office swung open.
Detective Riley, Marcia announced, and stepped aside to admit the old man.
He ambled in, looking around appreciatively.
Mr. Gutman, he said with a nod.
Barrett took one last drag and chucked the butt over the glass wall and down 30 stories to the street.
Detective, he said, as he came back inside.
He went straight to his desk chair and sat down. Riley took one of the chairs facing the desk, and Gutman, looking pained, got up from the sofa and did the same.
I've been out of the country, Barrett said. Elliot brought me up to date on what occurred during my absence, and I have to say, we both have a lot of questions about just what the hell you think you're doing.
Dismissing the charges against Shay Lambert, you mean?
Yes, Barrett rolled his eyes at the obviousness of it.
Yeah, it was bad, Riley said. Watching our case crumble like that.
What do you mean? Gutman said. You have plenty of evidence against her.
Yeah, we thought so too.
Riley turned to speak directly to him.
Turns out Mr. Barrett and Mr. Culligan doctored that surveillance video.
What?
Gutman's eyebrows knitted.
Get out, Barrett scoffed. The timestamps were altered to make it look like Ms. Lambert visited your wife's office that Sunday night. But in fact, that visit occurred on December 19th of last year. There's no evidence that she went to your wife's office on the night in question.
That's ridiculous!
Barrett held up a calming hand to Gutman.
And there's no evidence that your wife terminated Ms. Lambert's employment. The termination documents that Mr. Barrett produced were also tampered with.
Gutman looked at Barrett.
Barry?
He's lying.
Barrett pulled off his glasses and chucked them on the desk.
Then there's the supposed fraudulent resume found in Ms. Lambert's apartment. Her husband has now admitted that he was paid $30,000 to plant it there.
Barry?
That's a lie. Marcia! Barrett roared at the ceiling. Where the hell is Jack Culligan? He's supposed to be in this meeting.
I can't locate him, Mr. Barrett, the woman replied.
Oh, that's because he's in the Metropolitan Correctional Center, Riley said. Pending sentencing, as part of his plea deal with the government.
The government?
Gutman looked confused.
That would be the U.S. government, Riley clarified, on a charge of conspiracy to engage in human trafficking.
Gutman's jaw dropped at that last word, and Barrett felt the color leave his face like the tide going out.
He'll get a light sentence, though, in view of his cooperation with the investigation. Specifically,
Riley addressed this comment to Barrett,
the voice recordings he made of his conversations with you.
You're lying, Barrett bit out, but in his mind he could hear the uptick of a question at the end of his remark. Riley tilted his head back as if reciting a poem.
George Washington owned slaves. Thomas Jefferson even fucked his. This old damn country was founded on slavery.
Barrett felt the bottom of his stomach fall to the floor. Culligan, in the limo, with a lead pipe. Gutman stared at Riley, then swung back to Barrett.
What's he saying?
Bullshit. That's what he's saying. It's all bullshit. Same charges against you, Mr. Barrett, Riley said. Plus conspiracy to commit murder. See, the shooter named Tony Lowe, and Tony Lowe named you.
Barrett lurched to his feet. This meeting is over. Get the fuck out of my office.
Riley hauled himself out of his chair, but he wasn't done yet.
Two things happened that weekend, Mr. Gutman. The last weekend of your wife's life. Dozens of women were rescued from sex slavers, and an entire fishing fleet was lost at sea.
Gutman's eyes opened wide at the last bit. Barrett could see him remembering the typhoon and Lucy's reaction to the news.
Remember her text message? I can't do this anymore. The guilt must have been overwhelming. She couldn't live with it any longer.
Gutman blinked furiously.
I don't. What did any of that have to do with Lucy?
Those men and women. She sold them to the slavers. Marcia! Barrett roared. Call security. I want this son of a bitch out of here!
Riley held up his hands in mock surrender and headed out the door as Marcia's voice came through the speakers. It sounded tinny and strained.
Mr. Barrett? Reception just called. There are people here. They say they have a warrant.
Oh, right.
Riley turned back in the doorway.
That'll be FBI, with a warrant for your arrest.
With a parting grin, the detective shuffled away. Barrett fell back into his chair. Gutman was staring at him.
Ma Belle, Barrett said thickly. Show me the camera feed in reception.
The image flickered onto his desktop screen. The receptionist was on her feet, and in front of her stood half a dozen men, some in suits, some in windbreakers. Riley came into the frame and shook hands with some of them. His lips moved. Then he laughed as something streaked across the screen. Then something else. The doves were loose. They were swooping through reception, and the men were ducking and laughing while the receptionist crouched under her desk. In the back of the screen, the Mexican janitor could be seen tiptoeing around the knot of men and heading for the elevator. He probably thought they were from ICE, and he'd left the aviary door open as he made his escape. But they weren't from ICE. The back of the windbreakers said, FBI. Barrett groped for the framed photos at the front of his desk and turned them around until they were facing him. Melanie and his children. He stared at them, but they weren't looking at him. They were looking past him, to the trappings of his office,
the prestige it brought them. And the money. Of course, the money. He was the job, and the job was him. Without the job, he was nothing to them or to himself.
Barry!
Gutman cried as a white dove swooped into the office and dive-bombed his head. He batted at it in a way that reminded Barrett of Melanie batting away his kiss at the airport. The dove flew a figure-eight circuit of the room, landed briefly on the back of the white Chesterfield, then darted through the open door to the balcony. Barrett grabbed his cigarettes. I need a smoke, he said, and went outside. He flicked a flame from the lighter, but the wind extinguished it at once. He tried again, and failed again, and finally threw the lighter and the cigarette to the balcony floor. He'd hire the best criminal defense lawyer in the country. He'd hire Bill Centrello, who would dance circles around those government lawyers. He'd dream up some defense. He'd get the charges knocked down. They'd strike some kind of deal. A fine. Community service. But Barrett knew he'd never work again. He'd never have value to anyone in this world again. By the time he paid the fine and his legal fees, he'd have negative value. It was a sobering thought. He was literally worth more dead than alive. Voices sounded from inside. Men shouting. Marcia, losing all her composure. He pulled up to his knees on the ledge. He got one foot under him, and the other, and pushed up until he was standing on the narrow strip of stainless steel 30 stories above the city. A gasp sounded behind him. Marcia was at the door with her knuckles in her mouth, and behind her was Elliot Gutman, his jaw agape with horror. Barrett spread his arms and launched himself into a swan dive off the wall. 100 feet down, another dove fluttered past him, and he thought, we're both free now. But in another 100 feet, he had a different thought. He thought about that superpower he dreamed up, the ability to freeze all action in a scene. He wished he had that power, right this very...
Chapter 34. The technicians were just putting the final touches on the installation in reception when the reporter arrived, and I was there to greet him when he stepped off the elevator. I recognized him. I'd read his online bio and most of his recent clips before agreeing to this interview. Hello. I held out my hand. Shay Lambert. He'd come alone. The Wall Street Journal didn't run photographs with its profiles. I had to sacrifice my photo shoot when I chose the Journal over Vogue, but it was the right call. The investors read the Journal, and I worked for them now. He shook my hand. Matt Najarian. He was pleasingly paunchy and rumpled, living up to my every expectation of a print journalist. He nodded toward the swarm of people milling around the curtained wall behind the reception desk. What's going on? The unveiling of our new art installation. Come, let me introduce you to a few people. Lester Willard stood at attention on one side of reception. Alice, in a matching blue blazer, stood on the other side. Between them were most of our admin employees and a good contingent of the creatives in from Manhattan. I made the rounds with Najarian in tow. First, I introduced him to Nelson Ledbetter, our newly appointed CEO. He'd barely had time to set up his desk at Genco before the newly appointed board of CDMI lured him away. Does he have any background in fashion? The reporter asked as I steered him through the crowd. It was a setup question. He knew that he didn't. His expertise is in finance, I said, which is exactly what our shareholders want now. I pointed out Joe Riley, our new director of corporate security, looking dapper in a well-tailored suit. Does he have any experience in corporate security? Najarian asked. He's got a long and outstanding record in law enforcement, and obeying and enforcing the law is vital to our new mission here at CDMI.
Next was Cheryl Fitz, the labor and employment lawyer who was recently promoted from staff attorney to director of human resources. The four of us, Nelson, Joe, Cheryl, and I, were the new guard at CDMI. The old guard, the ones who'd ordered and executed the most shameful chapter in the company's history, were all gone. Two of them dead, and Jack Culligan and Phil Duvall serving sentences in federal penitentiaries.
Where are the doves?
Najarian looked around the reception area.
I heard there were doves.
Not anymore, I said. In light of recent history, keeping any kind of living creature in a cage is not something we wish to associate ourselves with. We've come up with something much more brand positive. Watch. A technician called Go, and Ledbetter went forward with a pair of oversized scissors. CDMI's new staff photographer crouched in front of him to capture the moment for the company's next annual report. Ledbetter mugged for the camera as he sliced through a wide ceremonial ribbon. The curtain puddled to the floor, and a gasp went up from the audience. Behind the glass wall where the doves once lived was a holographic diorama featuring a shimmering 3D image of Claudine DeMartineau. Her face and body were as they'd been during her prime modeling years, but the dress she wore was from this year's collection of CDMI's premier label, Graziella Atelier. She walked the length of the space and pivoted as if it were a catwalk, then whirled, and as the dress whirled with her, it morphed into a skirted suit from another of our top labels. The audience burst into applause at the seamlessness of the wardrobe change. Claudine took another stroll down the runway, and when she turned again, she was wearing a pair of high-waisted white trousers and a striped French sailor shirt from the Just Us sportswear line. The crowd applauded again. I turned to the reporter with a smile. What better brand ambassador than Madame DeMartineau herself? And now that she's passed on, this seemed like the best homage possible. When the hologram spun again, she shimmered into the same white Graziella sheath dress that I was currently wearing. The audience laughed and turned their applause my way. I gave a little wave to the hologram and a bow of acknowledgement to the crowd.
I guess you're a pretty good brand ambassador yourself,
Najarian said. I hope to be, I said, as champagne corks began to pop. Want to come back? Lester shadowed me as I headed out of reception. It's okay, Lester, I said over my shoulder. We'll be in my office. He nodded and stood down like the good soldier he was. I led the reporter down the corridor to my corner office. He let out a low whistle as he came in.
A lot of glass, he said,
turning a slow revolution through the room. Transparency, I said. That's our new watchword. He looked out at the balcony.
Is that where?
I gave a short nod. Can I get you anything?
No, thanks.
Please have a seat. I waved to one of the visitor chairs as I took my own seat in the high-backed leather chair behind the desk.
I see you have a virtual assistant.
The reporter nodded at the Ma Bell speaker on my desk. I brightened. Yes, it's a wonderful tool. Our R&D people have been doing amazing work with robotics, too. Garment manufacturing is the perfect application for robotics. Before long, sweatshops will be a thing of the past.
Displacing a lot of workers.
I shook my head. Relieving them of demeaning drudgery. Look, when mechanized farm equipment came along, it displaced a huge population of agricultural workers. But nobody's arguing that we should go back to toiling in the fields, because other jobs came along to fill the gap. Better jobs, with more meaningful work. Nobody has to be a field slave anymore. And someday soon, nobody will have to make clothes in a sweatshop either. That's the way forward. I could see he was growing restless with my sermonizing, but I went on anyway. This was the story the company needed to get out there. No more exploitation of labor. No more minimum wage workers. No more unpaid interns. It was a new day at CDMI. He let me wax on for a few more minutes
before he cleared his throat and changed the subject.
Our readers are more interested in how you personally were exploited. You spent 2 months in jail for a crime you didn't commit.
I sighed. It was inevitable that the interview would take this turn. Yes, and to answer your next question, yes, it was awful.
How did you manage to get through it?
An ordeal like that helps you discover just how deep your inner resources are. I had a wonderful mentor when I was a girl, Gina Casco, I said, and spelled it for him. She taught me how to visualize what I wanted to be and make it come true. I wanted to be strong in jail. I wanted to be a survivor. And so I was. He jotted that down and asked his next question without looking up.
It must be awful, having to come to work here every day, on that elevator.
I took a sharp breath and slowly let it out. Well, let me say first that it's an honor and a privilege to come to work here every day. I wouldn't have it any other way. But as for the elevator, yes, that's difficult. I mean, I let my voice falter a bit. That poor woman. He arched an eyebrow.
Poor woman? The one who sold almost 2,000 human beings?
On orders from above. Not that that's any excuse, obviously. But she had enough innate decency that she couldn't live with herself afterward. And that makes me sad for her.
But not for...
Najarian waved toward the balcony. No, I said tightly, not for him. He cupped his chin in his hand and gave me a long, probing look.
Can we go back to that day? February 2nd. Describe how it happened.
I half spun in my chair. I'd rather not.
It's not something you like to remember, I understand. But you must realize, there are some people who will always wonder what really happened in that elevator.
Do you? I parried. Wonder?
Oh, well.
He gave a shrug. There were only two possibilities, right? Murder or suicide. And one of them was eliminated by both the police and the district attorney. Do you know the legal term stare decisis? He shrugged again. Already decided, I said. Whatever question there was has been settled. Lucy killed herself.
But some people...
Let me tell you about our new worldwide labor standards. He sighed, and with a resigned nod, he scribbled some notes, while I held forth about the company's global initiatives in the fair labor practices. The interview, in fairness, by that point it was a diatribe, wound down after an hour. He pocketed his notepad and thanked me for my time, and I buzzed my assistant to show him out. After he was gone, I strolled out onto my balcony. The potted trees wore autumn colors now, and the air was crisp with the promise of fall. From here, I could see 30 stories down to the miniature cars snarled in a traffic jam at the intersection. But the blare of their horns was too faint to register, and the smell of their exhaust would never reach me up here. It was a bright, clear day, and I could see the skyline of Manhattan, the spires and crags of the buildings that housed the biggest and best law firms in the world. Once, I wouldn't consider working anywhere else, but no more. Now, those law firms worked for me. Still, there was a shadow over my mood, cast by that reporter asking about the incident. His question triggered a flash of images and sensations that cut like lasers through my brain. I felt faint with hunger again and almost delirious with exhaustion. I felt the rage that burned inside me as I stared into Lucy's wild animal eyes. I felt the chill of the cold metal trigger against my index finger. I heard the reverberating roar of the gunshot, and I smelled the spicy metallic zing of the gun smoke. My eyes squeezed shut as the flood of memories threatened to swamp me. No. I shook the images from my mind. I didn't want to revisit that scene ever again. Visualize, I remembered.
And so I visualized myself where I'd rather be, here at work. I went back inside and closed the door. "Jing Jing," I said to my office ceiling, "get me Eve and Tour." Epilogue. Digital voice recording, automatically made by the Ma Bell Virtual Assistant Program, February 2, 2014, at 9:02 p.m., via mobile app, registered to Lucy Barton Jones, and automatically saved to a remote server on a cloud farm in Virginia.
I know what you did.
What? What just happened? What did you do?
I didn't do anything. The power went out.
Oh, God. Push the alarm.
I already did. Hello? Security guard, can you hear me?
Nobody's answering. Why isn't anyone answering?
Looks like we're stuck. Locked in a cage. Now you know how that feels.
Don't.
1,800 people. Sold. Locked up. Shipped off like cargo. You did that.
Please, don't.
How can you sleep at night? How can you get up in the morning? How can you live with yourself after what you did?
Stop, please. I can't.
Can't what?
Live with myself. I can't. After those girls, those men on those boats.
You put them there. You.
It's like a curse. My family curse. Generation after generation. It has to end. I came here tonight to kill myself.
Oh, sure. Then why are you still breathing?
I couldn't do it. I have a family. I have children.
They had families, too. All those people you sold.
They can't know about this. My children. They have to be free from this curse. Which means they can never know. No one can ever know.
What? Oh my God! What is that? Put that away! What are you doing?
I can't have you walk out of here knowing what you know. I can't have you telling anyone about it.
No, Lucy, you don't want to do this. No! No!
What's your emergency?
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Cage, a novel by Bonnie Kissler, performed by Piper Goodeve and Chris Andrew Shula. Presented by HarperCollins and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Haley Silverman. Text copyright 2022 by Bonnie Kissler. Production copyright 2022 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.